You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be diving into the conclusion of Mary Astor's story. And the little girl who was at the center of the scandal and court battle that brought Mary onto the front page of every newspaper for a month in July of 1936. Her little girl, Marilyn. If you haven't listened to part one of Mary Astor's story, please go back and listen to that before listening to this episode. Let's dive back in. Little Marilyn Thorpe was suddenly the most famous little girl in the world. She turned 4 years old in June of 1936, and the following month, she was the reason behind the most heated and scandalous court battle LA had seen in years. A court battle that gripped the entire nation. Mary Astor had been awarded temporary custody of Marilyn at the start of the proceedings. And she employed two armed guards to protect her daughter. Her home was surrounded by gawkers and press night and day, and she was worried about kidnapping attempts. Marilyn was mostly cared for by her nanny, since both of her parents were pretty busy trying to destroy each other in court. Mostly on the side of Mary's ex-husband, Franklin Thorpe. He and his legal team were playing really ugly. He's the one that really started this whole mess with his threats, control, and blackmail over Mary's once private diaries that he stole and held hostage from her. He exercised one of the worst possible invasions of one's privacy. He read his wife's most private thoughts, every single word of her most intimate feelings. And then he used those written words to threaten and extort her. He put her in an impossible position. And he used their own daughter as a tool in his coercive ways. Mary Astor's lawyer was good, really good, carefully curating his questioning to catch Thorpe in proven lies and showcase his hot temper good. He had witnesses such as little Marilyn's nanny testify that Thorpe had more than one other woman spend the night in the same bed on numerous occasions. Which was very, very naughty in those days. One woman was a married woman, which made it double bad. He had testimony of one intoxicated girlfriend, actress Norma Taylor, who he got into a physical altercation with in front of little Marilyn, complete with two stabs from a turkey fork. When asked about this incident by a reporter, Norma replied, "Huh, that's a good one. I don't even eat turkey." Well, you don't have to eat turkey to use a turkey fork as a weapon. Marilyn, even at the age of 80 years old, remembered this incident. Mary's attorney did a superb job shining a realistic light on Dr. Franklin Thorpe's character during his time on the stand. Thorpe was trying to prove Mary to be an immoral character by flaunting hints of what her diary held. And her attorney was doing a great job showing that Mary Astor was a pretty good parent and citizen compared to her husband and his fork-yielding girlfriends. not to mention the testimony from nannies that he was physically abusive to his toddler daughter, like spanking her if she didn't play with toys the way he thought she should be playing with them, shaking her violently if she didn't cooperate with him, or whipping her little body until she got into a cold shower. She was 2 and 3 years old during these incidents. These accounts brought tears into Mary's eyes as she listened. This was her little girl. The moment the whole nation was waiting for arrived when it was Mary Astor's turn to take the stand. People couldn't wait to hear what she had to say, and if she was going to be asked about the details of her diaries. Her lawyer carefully asked her questions that proved to the court that Franklin Thorpe was not a nurturing father. In fact, he was a pretty harsh and abusive father. The press reported Mary's testimony like this. Quote, "Her testimony climaxed a day of sensations and filled the room with electric intensity." End quote. She was described as composed, demure, confident, and lovely. One paper wrote, quote, "Her low, deep, strong, vibrant, throaty voice, interrupted at times by gentle sobs, penetrated to every corner of the courtroom with perfect directness." End quote. So while Franklin Thorpe's time on the stand was riddled with angry outbursts and proven lies, Mary's reception was positive and sympathetic. But there was still the issue of the diaries. The diaries weren't admissible as evidence, much to the displeasure of Franklin Thorpe and his attorneys. But Franklin Thorpe still held the power to share those juicy and damaging contents with the world if he chose to do so. And as far as the diaries go, there was a lot of drama about them too. When trying to decide if they should be allowed in as evidence, it came to light that lots of sticky fingers touched those diaries on Thorpe's defense team. They had disassembled the diaries and there were pages missing that they claimed to have no idea what happened to. So there was then, of course, the accusation that there were things in the diaries that shined a bad light on Franklin Thorpe, which there for sure was a lot of, and that his defense team was trying to hide those words. They only wanted the entries that showcased Mary Astor in a bad light to be shown, particularly details about her relationship with George Kaufman. I should point out that this relationship is such a huge part of this whole ordeal because a married man and a married woman engaging in a romantic relationship together was way not okay. Very, very improper and considered incredibly immoral at the time. So Thorpe's defense team really wanted to focus on that relationship because it would make Mary look like an unfit mother and an overall bad person. Even though Franklin Thorpe also had a long-term girlfriend, longer term than even his marriage. But it was 1936, and a woman cheating on her husband was seen as horrible behavior, while men seemed to get away a lot easier with it because boys will be boys. It was messy. So by removing contents from the diaries, Franklin Thorpe hurt himself. The diaries would not be allowed as evidence. It finally came to a point, though, that Mary wanted the entire contents of her diaries to be open to the court and to the public if they had to be. She wanted everything she had written about her husband to be shown. His behaviors, his threats, his blackmailing, all of it. Little by little, juicy contents of Mary's diary were leaked to the press. Mostly words regarding George Kaufman. Things like, "He is perfect. I don't know how he does it. He is perfect." And referring to him as the Superman of the bedroom. But most everything the papers were reporting was later said to be fabricated. They were creating their own steam to make for a spicier story. Mary Astor was actively filming the movie Dodsworth in the middle of this heated custody hearing. Many have the opinion that this was her best performance, fueled by her heightened emotions over the trial. On the last day of filming, Mary was called into Sam Goldwyn's office and was surprised to see a whole gathering of the who's who of the Hollywood studios. Besides Sam Goldwyn, was Louis B. Mayer, Irving Thalberg, Jack Warner, Harry Cohn, Jesse Lasky, and others. The heads of all the major studios. All big, powerful Hollywood men that thought they ruled the world. They, of course, had a big plan to bully Mary into dropping the suit before the contents of the diary were made public. They, too, had heard the fabrication shared in the newspapers, and they believed that the diaries contained sexual details about tons of the most famous leading men in Hollywood. Pornography, as they called it. They tried telling Mary that she could be responsible for taking down Hollywood, for toppling down entire studios and ruining countless lives. That's pretty dramatic. This woman was just trying to win custody of her child and keep her from a harsh situation with her father, and she was being treated like a destructive monster. Like her diary alone could take down the entire Hollywood studio system. Mary Astor did not cave. She didn't care about her career or what Hollywood thought of her. Her only concern was her daughter. George Kaufman's worst nightmare came true when he did end up in the middle of this messy love triangle. He was summoned to court to testify, and he was nowhere to be found. He had gone into hiding, hoping this whole thing would just blow over. He wanted nothing to do with it. He was never found until after the trial was over, but his refusal to appear in court resulted in him being held in contempt. Judge Goodwin Knight announced that the moment George Kaufman set foot back in the state of California, he would be arrested. This trial went on way too long, and it had clearly become a match between two lawyers about the sexual lives of the other's client, not about what it was intended to be, the welfare of a small child. The judge finally had enough after weeks of witness questioning. They had 1.5 more days to settle this thing, he declared. Either come to an agreement in his chambers or finish it in the courtroom discussing only things that were directly related to the child's welfare and future custody agreement. In the end, after all of this messy drama that wasted the court's time and the taxpayers' dollars, a joint custody arrangement was reached, with Mary being granted with primary custody. And the infamous Purple Diaries became custody of the court. The missing sections were never recovered, and the diaries were sealed in the vaults of the Los Angeles Treasury, where they would remain sealed until little Marilyn Thorpe turned 21 years old. At that point, they were removed and destroyed. Why were they called the Purple Diaries? Well, they weren't bound or covered in purple. The ink Mary used was a color called Aztec Brown, but in the little glimpses the press was able to see, the writing looked purple. Mary's intimate purple words. A very frustrated and very relieved to be at the end of this media circus, Judge Goodwin Knight gave a very brief press conference at the closing of court on the last day of the trial. He said, quote, "The settlement fully protects the interests of little Marilyn, Mary Astor, Dr. Thorpe, and everyone else connected with the case. And contrary to rumors, there has been no pressure exerted upon me by the motion picture interests. Any pressure was placed upon the principals involved, not the court. I am only thinking of the baby. She is too young now to know what this is all about, but when she grows to womanhood, I would hate to have her feel that in this court, when she was only 4 years of age, she didn't have a friend." End quote. Franklin Thorpe was pissed at the judge's decision. He wasted no time preparing an autobiography to share his story with the world. He was actually already working on it during the trial. He planned a serialized account to be published chapter by chapter in various newspapers. The very next day after the trial commenced, the first chapter was published. The title was, "I Married an Actress." And as you can imagine, he painted himself as a saint and Mary as the worst person on earth. After his countless proven lies on the stand and the overwhelming sympathy for calm, cool, and collected Mary Astor, Thorpe's publications didn't really have the fire that he was expecting. Dodsworth, the movie Mary finished filming during this heated custody trial, was the most anticipated movie of the year of 1936. After all of this publicity, everyone wanted to see Mary Astor at work. At the film's Hollywood preview, Mary was met with a mob of cheering fans outside of the Hollywood Warner Theater. When she spoke her first line in the movie, the audience erupted in applause. At the end of the movie, when her name appeared on the ending credits, she was given a 2-minute ovation. This happened not only at that first preview showing with Mary in attendance, but in showings at theaters all over the country. The whole nation had Mary's back. So the media circus and Hollywood scandal that rocked the nation for a sweltering hot month in the summer of 1936 ended up strengthening Mary Astor's career instead of destroying it. She had the sympathy of parents all over the world because, despite whatever those diaries held or what she did in her private time, she was a mother who fiercely loved her child and wanted more than anything in the world to give her the love, care, and safety she needed. People saw that and they respected it. Shockingly, Mary Astor and Franklin Thorpe became friends after the fury of the trial calmed down. Mary kept her ex-husband as her and Marilyn's doctor for several years. And they even got close enough to briefly consider marriage again, but pretty quickly decided maybe that wasn't a good idea. Franklin Thorpe died in 1977 after a head injury that resulted from a fall. Mary Astor's name hit the front pages again just months after the custody trial and Purple Diaries had dominated the papers. In February of 1937, she married again, a man 7 years her junior named Manuel Del Campo. And unfortunately, he wasn't awesome. He would hit on women right in front of Mary, likely do more than that when she wasn't around, and he preferred partying over any kind of responsibility in life. They did have a child together, though, a little boy named Anthony, or Tano, before divorcing in 1941. Once Manuel left the marriage, he also left his duties as a father. Tano only spoke to his father a handful of times throughout the rest of his lifetime. Mary's career continued to fly high for a while after the scandal of 1936. She won an Academy Award for her role in The Great Lie in 1941, and she also starred in the film that would live to be her most recognized and praised role that year, The Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart. In 1943, Mary signed under contract with the biggest and best studio in Hollywood, MGM. And at the height of their success. It was with MGM that she appeared in Meet Me in St. Louis as Judy Garland's mother, which would set her into typecasted matronly roles. Drinking was a big topic in the custody trial of 1936. It came up a lot from both sides. Mary never drank too much. She rarely drank while working on a film and drank socially about as much as everyone else. Probably less. But that changed in the 1940s when she began drinking a little more, and a little more, and a little more, until the point where she was drinking way too much. She married her fourth husband in 1945, and he was a very heavy drinker, so this made Mary's drinking heavier too. Mary's mental health was suffering, and she used alcohol to self-medicate. And then, pills. It came to the point where she had to enter a substance abuse facility in 1949, or sanitarium as it was called then. Her fourth husband squandered almost all of her money, so that definitely did not help things. In May of 1951, After separating from her then-husband, Mary overdosed on sleeping pills. She was able to call for help before the effects kicked in, and she was saved. She insisted that it was an accident, but the police reported it as an attempted suicide. So the newspapers took that and ran with it. Mary Astor had once been one of the most successful Hollywood movie actresses. And at the age of 46 in 1952, she was near broke, suffering the horrors of addiction, in a deep depression, and was a Hollywood has-been. And then she woke up one day and decided she was not going to be defeated. She marched into a bank, took out a loan, and she headed east to work in the theater. She started in a traveling troupe, and then summer stock, and then she made her way onto a Broadway stage. And then producers of the new realm of television came knocking. Mary was back. She did stage and television work continuously for the next decade. A new chapter in her life, all thanks to her strength and determination to not give up. That's not all, though. Mary Astor also became a published author. It began with her autobiography in 1959, and it was a hit. Mary found writing thrilling. Remember, writing in these infamous diaries had been a very important outlet for her. "I'd seen my name on a hardcover book," Mary said, "and I found it a bigger thrill than seeing it in the marquee lights." A few years after the release of her best-selling autobiography, Mary released a novel. Writing was it for her. It brought her so much happiness and peace. Before I tell you about the remainder of Mary Astor's life, I want to tell you about the person who was at the center of the media circus that catapulted Mary Astor to the front pages of every newspaper and made her one of the most sought-after movie stars. Little Marilyn Thorpe. The little girl who was sadly used as a pawn between her parents' fight against each other. Marilyn was lost in the shuffle on this one. Much is said about Mary Astor and Franklin Thorpe, the diaries, what those diaries may hold, and the accusations of adultery that were brought out in the custody trial. But not much is said about Marilyn. She was the reason for all of this drama, her parents fighting, really nasty in Franklin's case, to give her a happy and nurturing life. So, did she end up having a happy and nurturing life? Marilyn was only 4 years old when the custody battle occurred between her mother and father. That is the age of child that I spend my days with as an early childhood educator. My job is to nurture and care for and provide happiness to four-year-olds. So reading the very detailed accounts of the trial were a little difficult for me. Marilyn later said that once her mother won custody of her, after all that drama, she didn't really spend any quality time with her. Her nanny was her primary caregiver. Marilyn had some wonderful things to say about her mother, but she also said she was often harsh and impossible to please. "She was always mad at me for something," she said. "I could never really please her." Does that sound familiar? Kind of like Mary with her own dad? Some of the time Marilyn did spend with her mother was on movie sets, and she was not a huge fan of that. Yes, it sounds pretty cool, but she was bored out of her mind. Even though it gave her the opportunity to meet Judy Garland and have lunch with Elizabeth Taylor, she met Humphrey Bogart, Spencer Tracy, Burt Lancaster, Tyrone Power, Shirley Temple, Marlena Dietrich, and, of course, her father's hunting buddy, Clark Gable. Pretty iconic shoulders to be rubbing as a child. Marilyn eventually tried a little acting, but she was never really into it. She gave it a whirl because she felt that it was expected of her, to try it at least. She had a couple small parts in high school and college plays, and she had a bit part in Little Women, the 1949 version in which her mom plays Mother March and also stars Elizabeth Taylor, Janet Leigh, June Allison, and Margaret O'Brien. Marilyn had one line in a schoolroom scene. Acting wasn't for her, though, and she was very grateful for that. She knew well how unglamorous things could be behind the scenes, going from her mother's emotional struggles and alcohol addiction. And she didn't want anything to do with that kind of existence. Marilyn got married in 1949, very young. She was only 18 years old, and her husband, Frank, was 27. Actually, they got married exactly on her 18th birthday. She admitted that she didn't really like Frank much, but she married him to get out of her mother's booze-riddled household. She wanted to distance herself from the erratic, alcohol-fueled behavior at home. In fact, it had gotten so bad by that time that Marilyn said her mother rarely got out of bed. Marilyn and Frank had a baby pretty quickly, and then three more. And since Mary was in such a bad place emotionally and in her battle with addiction, Marilyn and Frank took in her little brother Tano, too. Although Marilyn didn't feel she had the best upbringing or adequate emotional support, she never blamed her mother for her absences, whether it be physical or emotional. She was the best mother she knew how to be and did the best she could with the mental and emotional tools she had, Marilyn said. In short, Marilyn Thorpe herself was one remarkable woman. I took from her interviews that she was very intuitive, very understanding, and very forgiving. Maybe the circumstances of her child rearing were not perfect, but she turned out to be a pretty great person, very objective in her way of thinking. Marilyn later recalled her childhood as very lonely. She didn't realize it was anything other than ordinary at the time, but looking back, she realized that other children grew up with much more love and togetherness than she did. She spent 6 years in a boarding school, out of sight, out of mind. When she was home, in either her mother's or her father's home, she was always cared for by others. Marilyn, as an adult, recognized how her mother's childhood affected her own ability to be a parent. Marilyn gave a few interviews as an adult, but overall, the trial over her custody meant very little to her. It definitely did not define her life. In fact, she said she rarely thought about it. And when others brought up the subject, she moved on pretty quickly from the subject. When asked if she remembered that time period of her childhood, the time of the custody trial, she said, quote, "Frankly, I don't remember it being a difficult time for me. Life went on from day to day. I was well cared for. I lived in a beautiful house, had food and clothes. I was pretty well shielded from what my parents were going through. I don't remember being unhappy," end quote. When asked if she personally felt any blame should be placed on either of her parents, she said no, but went on to say, quote, "I'd say Mom had my welfare in mind. She didn't like how my dad treated me, and she was the one with the money to raise me. Dad just wanted to win in court for his own ego, which is still all right. We are all flawed in one way or another," end quote. She continued to say that she believes her mother winning primary custody was the best possible outcome. She said that her father always had at least one girlfriend around, sometimes more, so much that she said he would have made a great polygamist, and that he was addicted to his work as a doctor and really had no time for a child. It was Franklin's girlfriends who would primarily care for Marilyn on his days with her. Marilyn did say that she was very pleased with biographer Joseph Egan's book, the one that I used as my primary source for these episodes. She said, quote, "I think Joe did an exceptional job with the book. He's worked on the subject for years, his goal being to set things straight about the scandal my parents went through for my custody, overriding the lies of Hollywood Babylon," end quote. Let's shift back over to the rest of Mary Astor's life. Once Mary climbed her way out of the debilitating hole of depression and alcohol addiction, she kept really busy with stage and television work. Although out of the worst of it, she would continue to struggle with alcohol for the rest of her days. And then, in 1964, her Hollywood agent called. He told her about a movie with Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland that there was a small role that she could appear in. Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte. She reluctantly agreed to take her fingers off her typewriter, leave the peace and solitude of her quaint Malibu beach house, and return to the chaos of Hollywood filmmaking. And it was enough to make her decide that this would be the very last acting role that she would do. She was ready to completely close this long chapter of her life. She turned in her Screen Actors Guild card and officially retired from making films. With acting officially behind her, Mary Astor now returned all of her focus to her writing. She wrote two more novels and a second autobiography. The first autobiography was about her life, and the second was focused on her film career. And this second book was also very successful. It's actually considered one of the best books ever written about the nitty-gritty workings of making films during Hollywood's golden age. By her mid-60s, Mary was experiencing some pretty serious health issues. She had COPD and required the use of oxygen much of the time. And in 1971, she suffered a heart attack. She had been living with her son for a few years during her health decline, but after the heart attack, it was time for more professional care. Mary moved into a small cottage on the grounds of the motion picture and television country house in Los Angeles. Mary returned to the screen one final time in 1980 when she appeared in the television documentary series titled Hollywood, A Celebration of the American Silent Film. I did find that this program is available on YouTube, so check it out if you're interested. Mary enjoyed a quiet life in her small cottage at the Motion Picture Country House as she continued to suffer from severe respiratory issues. Her health finally declined to the point where she had to move from her private cottage into the Motion Picture Country Home Hospital. It was there that on September 25th, 1987, Mary Astor died. She was 81 years old. Mary's daughter, Marilyn, lived a fulfilling life, being married for 57 years and raising four children. In an interview from when she was 80 years old, she said she had lived a happy life. As far as I was able to find, I believe she is still with us today. She would be 93 years old. And now I would like to share some other interesting things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. Mary Astor had a commonly used nickname, Rusty, because of her dark auburn hair. Bullet point number two. Mary Astor's physician husband, Franklin Thorpe, saved the life of Clark Gable once. Through Mary's connection, Franklin and Clark had become hunting buddies. On one hunting trip, Clark Gable suffered appendicitis. Franklin rushed him to the nearest hospital and removed the appendix himself. Bullet point number three. Both of Mary Astor's children were born premature. Marilyn was born 4 weeks early while Mary and Franklin were on a yachting trip in Hawaii, which ended up being a very dangerous situation for both Mary and newborn Marilyn. Mary's son Anthony was born 5 weeks early. Bullet point number four. Mary Astor sold the Toluca Lake House that she, Franklin, and Marilyn had lived in to Frank Sinatra when he first went out to Hollywood. Marilyn said in an interview that Frank's wife Nancy had the house painted pink. Bullet point number five. Mary's daughter Marilyn said that her mother was not fond of Charlie Chaplin or Loretta Young. She said Charlie Chaplin was a bore, and Loretta Young looked like, quote, some underwater creature. She also didn't like Louis B. Mayer, but really, I think he was a little hard to like. In conclusion, Mary Astor was not given the guidance and support every child deserves to help guide them into a positive and healthy life. Instead, her father used her for his own benefit, not giving one thought or care as to how it may affect her for the rest of her life. Partly because of these unfortunate childhood events, Mary endured numerous struggles throughout her life. She struggled to keep healthy romantic relationships, she struggled with trust, she struggled with addiction, and she struggled as a parent herself. She was set forth into life with absolutely no support. She was on her own to figure it all out. And then the scandalous custody trial. Already struggling with trust issues, her husband took what trust she had left when he took her diaries and threatened to share them with the world, destroying her livelihood in the process. He committed the ultimate betrayal. If there was one place Mary felt safe and protected, it was within the covers of her private diaries. Luckily, the majority of the contents were kept private from the public, but Mary's husband and his entire defense team helped themselves to every single word of her most intimate thoughts and feelings. I can't even imagine the betrayal and horror of that. All of it was so unnecessary. Their child was the only thing that mattered. And sadly, she just got lost in the big drama shuffle. Marilyn Thorpe, as an adult, summed up the custody battle like this. The case was a battle of egos, and not for little Marilyn, because after I was won, I was cared for by others. Ironic, isn't it? Marilyn loved her mother, though. Looking back as an adult herself, she saw the difficulties that her mother was faced with. A controlling and abusive father, and a controlling and manipulative husband. Marilyn said her mother was a very unique woman. She had a wicked sense of humor, spicy is how she put it. She spoke her mind, she was well-read and well-informed, a good listener, very creative, and she had quite a mouth on her. Mary Astor sounds like a really incredible woman, someone who would have been really great to be around. She was dealt a bad hand in life, and she did pretty well with that, all things considered. Thank you, Mary Astor, for showing us how important it is to stand up for ourselves. As difficult as it may be, we all deserve the opportunity to fight for what is right. And thank you all for listening. Don't forget to rate the show and give a review if possible where you listen to your podcasts. And please visit patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast if you want to gain access to a ton of great bonus content. Each month, I release a full-length bonus episode, a movie of the month recap episode, and our newest feature, Cocktail Party. With that, I share a vintage cocktail recipe, give you my review of it, and then I read you some juicy content from old newspapers and magazines featuring some of our favorite Golden Age stars. Lots of great stuff. So as a thank you for supporting the production of this show, I'll give you all kinds of great bonus content. Patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast. For this episode, I use the book The Purple Diaries, Mary Astor and the Most Sensational Hollywood Scandal of the 1930s by Joseph Egan. I also use the Mary Astor Collection at themaryastorcollection.com. And of course, IMDb.